Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 330, of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in today's podcast, we'll be continuing the rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK / Step 3 exams. As a reminder, I have an MBME Test Taking Strategies class coming up next Thursday from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. We go over a lot of questions, very helpful tips, and just practical principles and strategies for answering MBME questions correctly. Pretty much every kind of MBME question, ethics questions, questions where you don't even have the requisite knowledge to answer it correctly. I'll give you tips for increasing your probabilities of answering those questions right. Again, I've had many people attend these courses and they've done really well. And then I have a 20-hour review course for the USMLE Step 2 CK exam, and also it's applicable to Step 3. That's going to be next week, Friday and Saturday. That's going to be the 13th and 14th of August. It's 10 hours each day. We'll have, you know, little breaks. We'll have like a 2-hour break on each day. And again, we cover a ton of content from peds, surgery, psych, OB-GYN, neuro, internal medicine, ethics, biostatistics, communications, healthcare systems, ethics, just many, many different things, right? Again, I've had tons of people attend these courses, and I've gotten really good results from it. I've had many people do extremely well on the exams after taking the course. So in about basically like a 2-day period, or I guess like 2 days and about 3 hours, you learn like a very good chunk of the information that's tested on the exam. And you also get better at manipulating these MBME questions. So let's just jump right into it. So what if they give you a question about like a 2-year-old child and they tell you that this child, you know, or actually like a 6-month-old child, and they tell you that this child has like a red raised lesion on the face, and the child is completely asymptomatic, the child's vitals are completely normal, and they tell you that it's red, or they may say it's like purplish. If you see stuff like that, what do you want to think about? Well, I would hope you're really saying that, oh, Divine, this child likely has some kind of hemangioma, right? So remember, hemangiomas, right, they are like a vascular lesion, right? So that's a buzzword you want to know, because sometimes they may not put hemangioma as an answer. Let me just say vascular lesion, right? But it's benign. For the most part, you don't have to do anything to it. It will regress over time. But if for some bizarre reason, your friends at the MBME want you to pick some kind of treatment, I'll encourage you to pick the answer that says propranolol. Propranolol is an amazing, excellent drug for treating hemangiomas. So I'll encourage you, consider going with propranolol in those circumstances. Now, as a variant question, I guess, is what if they give you a question about a person and they describe, you know, what looks like a lesion of hemangioma, but then they then say something along the lines of the person having petechiae, the person having all these bleeding episodes, and it's a child, and they may even give you a platelet count, and the platelet count is really, really low, right? If you see that, what do you want to think about? Well, I hope you're saying, oh, Divine, this person likely has the Cassa-Bach-Merritt syndrome, right? So Cassa-Bach is spelled K-A-S-A. B-A-C-H, right? So Cassa-Bach and then Merritt, I believe, is M-E-R-R-I-T-T, right? So the Cassa-Bach-Merritt syndrome, that's basically where you have a hemangioma. And that hemangioma has the ability to sequester platelets, right? So those are all things you want to keep in mind with the Cassa-Bach-Merritt syndrome. So because it's sequestering platelets, those people are going to have thrombocytopenia, and they're going to have other antecedents of thrombocytopenia like PTKI, bleeding, and things of that sort. Now, all on the same concept of hemangioma, right? So what if they give you a question about a person and they tell you, they describe like an abdominal CT finding in the liver. What is the abdominal CT finding in a liver hemangioma? This is something they love to test. It's something that, you know, you just, I mean, like as a radiologist, you can understand the mechanics and the pathophysiology of why this holds, but that pathophysiology is well beyond the scope of our discussion. So I'm going to skip that today. But how does it classically show up on an abdominal CT? Of, you know, where you're looking at the liver. Well, the key thing I want you to remember is that you're going to first have peripheral enhancement, right, in the early phase of the arterial study, right? So the person is getting contrast through angiography. And then in the later phases, you're going to see centripetal feeling. So basically, it's almost like at first, you have feeling of contrast around the lesion, like in the periphery, like in a circle. But then it's almost like all that contrast then starts traveling towards the center, although it's obviously traveling through blood vessels. But again, I'm not going to go into much detail on that. But you do need to make sure you understand and know what a hemangioma in the liver, a hepatic hemangioma, typically presents with. So that's something that's kind of important to know on exams. And then just one last hemangioma-related lesion, right? So what if they give you a question about a patient? And they tell you that this patient has a, you know, has a very high hematocrit, and this patient has like has been having headaches for the last 3-4 months, and they tell you that you see a calcified posterior fossa mass in this person, right? The first thing I want you to think about, right, obviously, is going to be von Hippel-Lindau syndrome, right? Remember, it's a problem with chromosome 3, and the mutation is in the VHL gene, right? It's actually an autosomal dominant disorder. So you may be like, okay, Divine, what in the world is this posterior fossa mass you keep referring to? Well, the posterior fossa mass I keep referring to in this circumstance is actually a hemangioblastoma, right? So a hemangioblastoma will be a posterior fossa mass, or it will be a cerebellar mass, and that mass will contain calcifications. And many times it makes EPO in a paraneoplastic fashion. So if you make EPO in a paraneoplastic fashion, that will obviously, right, that will obviously cause the person to have a polycythemia. Right, so the person's polycythemia will be associated with elevated levels of erythropoietin. Right, so one thing our friends at the MBMEs love to do in the more recent exams these days is ask, well, which of the following is the most likely complication, right, or most likely future malignancy you need to, you know, watch out for in this patient? Well, I'll hope you're saying, oh, Divine, I want to think about like this person having like a cancer of the kidney, right, like renal cell carcinoma. So most times those people, you generally want to follow them every now and then with imaging of the abdomen. Because the thing is, people that have von Hippel-Lindau, they can develop renal cell carcinomas, and they can also develop pancreatic cancers, right? So renal cell carcinomas, pancreatic cancers, those are two things that you want to keep at the back of your mind with von Hippel-Lindau syndrome. And then what if they give you a question about a child and they tell you that this child, you know, always has seizures, and then they tell you that, oh, they perform a skin exam and they find all these hypopigmented lesions. Well, if you see this, I'll hope you're thinking about one of these neurocutaneous disorders, right? So this is going to be tuberous sclerosis. Remember, in tuberous sclerosis, they tend to have these dermatologic findings like ash leaf spots, right? Remember, you need to be able on your exams to differentiate the ash leaf spots of tuberous sclerosis from the café au lait spots of neurofibromatosis type 1. Right, so the ash leaf spots are hypopigmented lesions. The café au lait spots are hyperpigmented lesions, right? And those are things you find in tuberous sclerosis. And remember, tuberous sclerosis, again, it's an autosomal dominant disorder. And basically, the mutations you have are in proteins like in genes called the TSC1 and the TSC2 genes, right? And again, many of these kids that have tuberous sclerosis, they tend to have really bad intellectual disability. They tend to have seizures. In fact, many times on NBM exams, it tends to be associated with a seizure disorder called infantile spasms, right? Remember, another name for infantile spasms is West syndrome. And many times, right, they will tell you that, oh, on an EEG, you see a hypsarrhythmia, right? Although these days, our friends at the MBMEs, they are getting a lot wiser, right? So instead of putting the term hypsarrhythmia, they will describe a hypsarrhythmia to you, right? So how can you describe hypsarrhythmia to a medical student? Well, you can put in a jumble of words and then say something along the lines of chaotic background. If you see stuff like that, then I want you to think about the person having infantile spasms, or, you know, again, it's called a West syndrome, right? So chaotic background, they'll put some words and then they'll put with a chaotic background. If you see stuff like that, I want you to think about infantile spasms. And remember, the drug of choice for treating infantile spasms on MBM exams is ACTH, right? Is ACTH. So instead of putting ACTH, sometimes they can just put cosyntropin. Remember, cosyntropin is an ACTH analog, right? So it's just something you want to keep at the back of your mind on exams. And please don't forget, tuberous sclerosis actually has an unusual association with a person having autism, right? Tuberous sclerosis has an association with people having autism. Remember, there are many pediatric genetic disorders that have a very strong association with autism, right? So like, for example, those two chromosome 15 disorders, right? Those Q11, Q13 disorders of chromosome 15, like, you know, they can give you a boy that is super, super, super obese. He's like at the 99th percentile for weight, and he has like mild intellectual disability, right? Prader-Willi syndrome, right? Remember, those people, it's a paternal chromosome mutation. That's also associated with autism. And also, if you look at the counterpart in ladies, right, in females, right, where they'll have, they have like this happy cry, it's going to be in a female, and it's a mutation from mom's chromosome 15, Q11, Q13, right? Angelman syndrome, right? Sometimes they call that the happy puppet syndrome, right? So those people usually have like ataxia. They'll have like all these Parkinsonian features, right? So they'll have like ataxia. They'll have like these tremors, right? And they're always happy, and it's going to be in a girl. That's going to be Angelman syndrome, right? So Prader-Willi and Angelman syndromes are both associated with autism, right? And then there's this syndrome in girls, right? So they can give you a question about a girl, and they'll tell you that, you know, she was fine at birth. She was fine for the first few months of life. And then after that, she just started crashing and burning, right? She just started going downhill from a developmental perspective, right? And many times those girls tend to have a lot of hand flapping movements. If you see something like that, I want you to think about Rett syndrome. Remember, Rett syndrome arises from an MECP2 gene mutation, right? A MECP2, MECP2 gene mutation. That is absolutely associated with autism as well, right? And then obviously, right, the classic ones that the NBM knows that most people know, right? So things like Fragile X syndrome, things like Down syndrome, all those things have a very strong association with autism, right? But remember, Fragile X syndrome also has a very good association with ADHD, right? Fragile X syndrome does have a very strong association with ADHD, right? So that's just something to keep in mind. Another ADHD-associated disorder in kids is the chaff of a mom that, you know, drinks a ton, right? So like fetal alcohol syndrome has a very strong association with ADHD. Remember, people that also have fetal alcohol syndrome, they can get VSDs, and also the lower part of their bodies can be hypoplastic, right? That's something called cyrenomelia. That's something that, believe it or not, they love to test a lot on exams, right? So just as a recap, right? Fetal alcohol syndrome is associated with ADHD. It's associated with cyrenomelia, right? So basically, the lower part of the person's body does not develop properly. It's also associated with having a VSD, okay? VSDs are probably like one of the most common cardiac congenital anomalies in kids that have fetal alcohol syndrome. Okay, now what if they give you a question about a person that, you know, is on TPN, and this person on TPN, you know, their blood pressure has been going down over the last like 12 to 24 hours. Their blood pressure has been going down. Their heart rate has been going up, and they have like this fever, right? If you see this, what are you thinking about? Well, I would hope you're really saying, oh, Divine, this person likely has a clabsy, right? So what in the world is a clabsy? Well, a clabsy is a central line associated bloodstream infection. Because remember, if a person is getting TPN, they need to get it through a central line. Right? And many times they will ask you on NBMEs, oh, what is the most likely complication of TPN administration? And they will try to trick you on your exam into picking a calculus, cholecystitis. Don't do that, right? Pick the answer choice that talks about a central line associated bloodstream infection, right? So the thing is, again, this will be in a person that is getting a central line of some sort, right? And the thing is, most times when a person has gets a central line associated bloodstream infection, it's usually going to be like a mixture of like different bacteria, but most times it's going to be your skin flora, right? So like your coagulase negative stuff, like staph epidermidis, for example, right? Although sometimes you can also say like staph aureus and things of that nature, right? But again, these people will have a septic picture, and you'll notice that, oh, recently or a few days ago, they had a central line that was placed in them, right? So whenever you see stuff like this, well, what are you going to do? Well, typically the thing you're going to do for people that if you suspect that a person has a central line associated bloodstream infection, usually the smart play is to say, you know what, let's go ahead and get two cultures, right? So the first one, you're going to get it from the catheter itself, right? You're going to get it from the catheter itself, right? Because most times you insert the central line in the peripheral vein, right? You know, some people put it in the subclavian vein, some put it in the jugular veins, some put it in the femoral vein, right? Obviously, if you want to lower the risk of infection, probably makes sense to not do a femoral central line, right? Because those femoral central lines, right? You're kind of like in the perineal area, kind of setting yourself up for infection, right? But these people, you're going to get two venous blood samples, right? So the first one is going to be from the catheter. The second one is going to be from any other peripheral vein in the body, right? Now, the key thing to keep at the back of your mind is that if it's a central line infection, then the specimen you get from the central line will grow way faster than the specimen that you get from the other peripheral vein, right? So that differential growth, right, where you have like much higher growth in the catheter sample in comparison with the other peripheral vein sample, that pretty much tells you what you're dealing with. That tells you that, okay, this is likely a central line associated bloodstream infection, right? And the good thing to do is, treating a CLABSI is actually pretty easy. All you essentially have to do is get rid of the catheter, right? And then put the person on vancomycin, right? So remove catheter, put the person on vancomycin, and that usually will usually take care of the problem. So now my next question is, what is true of the cardiac pressures in a person that, let's say, they have COVID-19 and they go into hypoxic respiratory failure, and they need to be intubated? So what should you expect of the cardiac pressures in those people? Well, it's actually pretty easy. Most times in those people, right, obviously this person has ARDS. And remember, you need to be able to recognize ARDS on a chest x-ray. They almost never test ARDS on CT scans on the exam, but they love to test it on a chest x-ray, right? So what are the fun, fancy things you need to know about ARDS from a chest x-ray perspective? Remember, you're going to find this bat wing appearance, right? This bat wing or angel wing appearance, right? So bat wing or angel wing appearance. So the thing is, these people, right, usually it's because they have like systemic inflammation, right? And remember, whenever you have inflammation, you're going to release all these inflammatory markers like histamine, heparin, leukotrienes, and things like that, bradykinins. And those things are very powerful vasodilators. And in addition to that, they also increase your vascular permeability. So the thing is, if you increase the vascular permeability, then that's going to make it possible for fluid to leak into the presence of alveoli, right? And that will inactivate surfactant and cause problems, right? So ARDS, right, the pathophase is you have an increase in the vascular permeability, right? So the thing is, remember, ARDS is a problem that happens in the lungs. So because it's a problem that happens in the lungs, well, what will be true of the pulmonary capillary wedge pressure? Well, I hope you're saying that the pulmonary capillary wedge pressure will be normal. It'll be less than 18, right? Because these people pretty much have a pulmonary edema. But this pulmonary edema they have is non-cardiogenic, right? They have a non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema, right? A non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema. So that's the thing that tells you, oh, okay, this person has a normal PCWP, right? But another thing to keep in mind is what will be true, because again, the problem is proximal to the left heart. So they are left atrial pressures, right, which we also call the pulmonary capillary wedge pressure, is completely normal, right? But in terms of these people's CVP, right, the right side of the heart, well, think about it. The right side of the heart drains into the pulmonary arteries, right? So these people's right sides of their hearts will have elevated pressures because, again, things are not moving along very well, right? Because these people are hypoxic. They have a lot of pulmonary vasoconstriction kind of gumming up the works in their lungs, right? So these people have elevated right-sided heart pressures. In fact, their CVP, right, the central venous pressure, which is a surrogate for the right atrial pressure, will be increased in people that have ARDS, right? And again, if a person has ARDS and you put them on a vent, remember you need to pursue what I call lung protective strategies, right? So you need to put them on low tidal volume and high PEEP, right? Low tidal volume and high PEEP, because those are things that will protect their lungs. And again, one thing that's also been shown to improve our mortality in people that are being treated for ARDS with a ventilator is that they lie on their belly, right? So you make them prone in the ICU or whatever, and that actually does help with improving the oxygenation. Actually does help with improving their oxygenation. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that, oh, this patient has, you know, has been smoked two packs per day for the last 39 years, right? And then they tell you that this person for the last 2 days, they've been having a productive cough, they've been producing a ton of sputum, right? They've been having a fever. And then they ask you for the most likely offending organism. If you see that, I really hope you're saying, oh, Divine, this is easy. This is probably going to be H flu. Remember, in general, on MBM exams, Haemophilus influenza is probably one of the most common causes of pneumonia in patients that have COPD, right? Or in patients that are big time, long term smokers, right? So again, these are all things to keep at the back of your mind for exams, right? And remember, one thing that's actually kind of high yield to know, they can give you a question about a woman that is pregnant and she has a history of HIV. And then they'll say something along the lines of, how can we prevent her from transmitting this HIV to a newborn? Well, if you see that, the thing I want you to think about is give her zidovudine. And then right after the child is born, go ahead and give this child zidovudine as well, right? Sometimes some people will say, okay, let's wait for a few hours, like, 7, 8, 9 hours after birth to give this child zidovudine. But while mom is in labor, you need to give AZT, right? Zidovudine. That's actually going to help with reducing the morbidity. Reducing the risk of transmitting a HIV infection to the child. Okay. And then the last thing I think I want to say here is, what if they give you a question about a person and they tell you that they have a lot of just interfamily problems, right? Dad is fighting mom. Mom is fighting daughter. Daughter is fighting dad. Dad is fighting daughter, right? Whenever you see all these inter-family conflict, like so within one family, there's a lot of conflict. And they ask you for how you should treat those people. The big thing I will encourage you to pick up on your exam is a kind of CBT called family therapy. Family therapy is extremely, extremely, extremely effective for treating, maladaptive family dynamics. But remember that family therapy is also a very good CBT option for people that have anorexia nervosa, right? Because the thing is, again, many times people that have anorexia nervosa, they tend to have, very maladaptive family dynamics. So since this is a rapid review, I'm going to go ahead and pause here. Again, as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams, step 2 CK, step 3, preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. And then I also offer these review courses for the USMLE Step 2 CK and Step 3 exams, although these courses are largely beneficial to also people taking Comlex Level 2 and 3. And then I do have my podcasts on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, on Spotify, at least the most recent 150, right? So that's where I put any new podcasts I make, right? So obviously I've made 330 podcasts, so that means there's 180 or 190 somewhere. Well, the thing is, that's going to be on the website. So if you want everything from episode 1 to the present time, go on the website, divineinterventionpodcasts.com, right? Because again, the thing is, it's a WordPress rule. You can't put more than your most recent 150 podcasts. And again, the website that I have, you don't have to do any kind of sign up or login. Just go there, click on it, and download whatever you want. Just search for the episode you want. And if you also look, there's an episode notes feature where there are notes from many of my podcasts and videos. And then if you look at exam topics list, it's a spreadsheet that will give you, it kind of shows you for step 2 CK is broken down by subject, for step 1 broken down by subject, exactly what you should study for each of those subjects. I update it whenever I make a new podcast. And then I'll encourage you, listen to the podcast if you can, and then read the notes alongside. You'll just get much better understanding, because again, sometimes people just write notes and just write out the facts, right? You may not necessarily get the understanding. So listen to the podcast to get the understanding. And then, again, I have a YouTube channel, Divine Intervention USMLE podcast and videos, right? If you go there, you can, again, watch the videos that I've posted. And then, in addition to that, I do have a new website and a new podcast. It's called Divine Intervention Life Lessons. Again, I still give life lessons with these My Medicine podcasts, but I feel like a lot of people have emailed me like, Divine, I really love your life lessons. So I actually have a divineinterventionlifelessons.com website. I've so far put up 10 really good podcasts there. They're all under 10 minutes long, right? So it's, you know, just some Bible-based teaching that just kind of teaches you some life lessons that can really help you succeed in life. And I also have the podcast on Apple Podcasts, actually. It's called Divine Intervention Life Lessons. So if you're looking for that, again, just please subscribe to those. I kind of intend it to be like a devotional for people to listen to and, you know, listen to it on the go and get something from it, or, you know, listen to it while you're sitting down or whatever and be blessed by it. So, and if you're applying for ERAS with this cycle, if you need help with personal statements and your ERAS applications, again, I work with people on that. Again, I've worked with tons of people that have had question marks on the applications and they are now residents, right? Some of them are even about to graduate, believe it or not, from residency. I've done this for a couple of years. And again, I have experience, you know, again, being on an admissions committee and just working through many of these residency processes. So if that's something you're interested in, just shoot me an email through the website and I'll be happy to give you some more information. So thank you for listening. I'll see you next time. God bless you. Thank you.